There may be a political debate over the reality of global warming, but in the Southwest, temperatures are rising, and that threatens to diminish already scarce water supplies. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio, and this is Fronteras, a public radio show about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. A 2014 United Nations report suggests that globally, the burden of climate change will impact the poor the most. Some of the most marginalized communities in the United States are found along the border between U.S. and Mexico. Daniel Salinas has the story from KRWG in Las Cruces, New Mexico.
90% of New Mexicans get their drinking water from the ground. It's a supply fed by melting snowpacks from mountains, rivers, and streams. But with rising temperatures and warmer and shorter snow seasons, less of that water is making it into the aquifer. To keep up with plummeting water levels, municipal and private wells are getting drilled deeper and deeper into the earth. This one in Las Cruces, New Mexico, is going down 160 feet. For people living in low-income communities along the U.S.-Mexico border known as colonias, that's not a viable option. Many residents depend on shallow wells dug by hand.
People here, they know how to do it, so they do it by hand.
Resident Maria Covernali says when she finally struck water 25 feet below her home near El Paso, Texas, she and her family couldn't drink the water because it was not safe. They used it to shower and do laundry until they realized it wasn't even good for that.
The clothes was like turning yellow.
And that's a minor problem compared to health concerns. A University of Texas Health Impact Study reported high concentrations of arsenic and nitrates in many colonias' water supplies. They also found higher than normal rates of waterborne diseases among colonias' residents. Many reported cases of diarrhea, dysentery, and skin lesions.
We used to take a shower with that water, too, but the skin was with a lot of rashes. I have, you know, scars from that. That's what a doctor told me. Well, you're going to have that all your life just because of the water. I said, oh, my God.
Municipal water systems can treat these impurities. Covernali says many residents bought land from developers with assurances that it would eventually be piped into nearby water systems.
The developers take advantage of the people. After we start living on the land, we see the problems that we face.
A lot of people living in colonias have to haul in their water in tanks or buy bottled water. And some scientists are concerned climate change is going to leave more people without access to running water. William Hargrove is director for the Environmental Resource Management at the University of Texas, El Paso.
Well, they're very vulnerable in terms of climate change. During very hot and dry times, maybe the water table drops. It could drop below their intake. And they could be without water for a time period during the hottest time of the summer. People living in colonias and living in rural areas, they're also living kind of in the context of also agriculture, irrigated agriculture. Farmers are also pumping water to apply to their crops and makes people who have a domestic well vulnerable.
Pecans, alfalfa, and cotton are all thirsty crops grown in Chamberino, New Mexico, where Patrick Marquez lives with his family. Marquez says his well runs dry for a couple weeks every year while the farmers are pumping water out of the aquifer.
Thank God to my neighbors that, you know, I've been able to run a garden hose to give me water so at least my kids can take a shower and, you know, we can use the facilities.
According to the Housing Assistance Council community report, the Marquez and Covernali families are just some of the 1.5 million people living along the border who depend on vulnerable water supplies.
I'm living here in the United States of America, so I'm supposed to have water.
A few years ago, Covernali decided to take matters into her own hands, starting Familias Triunfadoras, a nonprofit to organize residents and effect change. And she's had some success getting developers to follow through on agreements to pipe water into colonias. She's also secured housing and urban development grants to build water infrastructure.
And I said, no more. I have to do something for me, for my kids, and for the community.
Marquez says he conserves water where he can, but he says it might be for naught if farmers aren't willing to plant more water-efficient crops. Unlike large-scale farmers, Marquez says he can't afford to keep digging deeper wells.
It is falling on the average person because, you know, we're the ones that are going to suffer. More people need to be aware of the water situation. You know, they need to conserve. I'd have to think of the welfare of my children.
A NASA climate study projects Southwest water will only be diminished further with an even harsher drought projected in the next 30 years. Reporting from Las Cruces, New Mexico, I'm Daniel Salinas.
Daniel is a student reporter and part of the PBS NewsHour Reporting Lab project. There's another situation in northern New Mexico, a dilemma faced by pregnant women living in rural areas there. When their babies are coming, the race to the hospital can take over an hour. That's because they have to travel over 60 miles to deliver their babies with a doctor or midwife. In addition, they face another challenge, getting physicians to work where they live. KUNM's Sarah Trujillo explains.
Isabel Ortega is nearing the end of her third pregnancy. She lives in Las Vegas, New Mexico, where there's no one to deliver babies anymore. She was given the option to drive to Santa Fe, Taos, or Albuquerque for delivery, but
I honestly don't think I would be able to make it to Albuquerque while I'm having contractions and all this and that.
Ortega and her husband decided to go with Santa Fe, which is the closest, but still an hour away. She says they're both worried about the day she goes into labor. She imagines the drive.
He'll have to be in the back with me trying to calm me down and have somebody else drive us. So we're still trying to figure out our plan as to who's going to go with us or if anybody can go with us.
They have two young children and both work full time. Ortega says each time she's gone into labor has been different. Shortly before her second child came, she had severe back pain, so they went to Alta Vista Regional Hospital. That was before the hospital stopped offering maternity services and closed its obstetrics unit in March of last year.
I was just 10 minutes down the road, but those 10 minutes seemed like they were forever.
This time around, Ortega was getting care at Alumbra Women's Health and Maternity Services, a midwifery in Las Vegas. But the midwives there could only go so far. They had to have an attending physician during deliveries. And with no OBGYN in the area, they were only allowed to offer prenatal care.
The only way we were going to make it was to start delivering our babies again. And there was so much uncertainty about when that would be. I just didn't see much sense in it.
That's Connie Trujillo. She was a midwife there and says without the funds from deliveries, they were barely staying afloat.
This year so far, every month has been a loss financially, and we've really cut down our costs.
They had cut staff and trimmed their hours. They hosted fundraisers and applied for grants. In the end, it just wasn't enough, Trujillo says, but she wants their work to continue.
Because I feel that we really need a more sustainable healthcare system in our community.
All of the midwifery's patients were transferred over to Christus St. Vincent, the hospital in Santa Fe. Trujillo says they tried partnering with them, but things didn't work out, and the waiting had already taken its toll. The midwifery closed in June.
I can't afford to go into any more debt. I'm already in a hole. It would just have gotten deeper.
And the hospital in Las Vegas that stopped providing maternity care? No one there would do an interview with KUNM, despite over a dozen requests. Alta Vista did release a statement saying there were two new hires for their obstetrics unit, who will start this fall. Still, more than half of the physicians in the state are working in Bernalillo County. Barbara Weber from Health Action New Mexico says getting doctors to move to rural areas has always been a challenge.
And especially when you get into OBGYN, that's an on-call, 24-hour commitment.
Weber says New Mexico is lucky to have freshly graduated doctors come here to work off their student debts.
But they're also considering family. Is there going to be a job in a rural area for your spouse? And are you going to get the schooling you want for your children?
They often leave. Almost half of the state's population is on Medicaid. Couple that with the healthcare tug of war at the federal level, and Weber says things here could get much worse.
There are economic reasons to be concerned, but I think there's just a moral and a human point of view that this is our children.
Las Vegas is just one example of this kind of situation in New Mexico. Women in Tucumcari have to travel almost an hour and a half to Clovis for delivery. And in Santa Rosa, women have to go to Albuquerque, which is nearly a 2-hour drive. I'm Sarah Trujillo.
The number of refugees admitted to the U.S. has plummeted since President Trump took office. And last week, the Supreme Court allowed parts of Mr. Trump's travel ban on refugees to take effect. For those families already here, they're eager to return to normal lives, including educating their kids. Until recently, many schools in Austin were unable to offer support for languages such as Arabic. But as KUT's Nadia Hamdan reports, that changed when a group of student volunteers from the University of Texas stepped in.
I have a question.
What's your question?
It's the final week of classes at Harris Elementary. UT graduate student Kim Grimaldi is meeting with her students one last time before summer vacation. Second and third graders Amira and Sajeda, both from Sudan, sit across from her at a small half-moon-shaped table. While working on multiplication, Amira starts sounding out the words on Grimaldi's shirt. Their English is advanced.
Why is this like M-E-N?
What do you think that spells?
Mentor.
As you probably gathered, Grimaldi is a mentor with UT's Refugee Student Mentor Program. It's a collaboration between UT's Department of Middle Eastern Studies and the Austin Independent School District. UT students who speak foreign languages like Arabic, Farsi, and Pashto serve as mentors to refugee children a few hours a week. The program was started in the spring of 2015 by Dr. Jonathan Kaplan. He's an assistant professor with UT's Middle Eastern Studies Department. Back then, he noticed more refugee students coming to Doss Elementary, where his daughter goes to school.
Doss ended up with an influx of 30, 40 refugee students who didn't speak English at all, whose parents didn't speak English at all, and were in a very difficult place.
This year alone, AISD enrolled over 1,000 refugee students. Most of these families are coming from places like Iraq, Syria, Sudan, and Somalia. That's when it clicked for Kaplan. He introduced the idea for the mentorship program to his colleagues, and they quickly jumped on board. After some success at Doss, the program began spreading to other Austin campuses. Now they have over 50 mentors. Not all of them are proficient in Arabic or Pashto. Many are beginners themselves, but these volunteers are still valuable, says the program's co-coordinator, Thomas Letty Sassir.
Even if all you can do is say good morning to a kid and ask how they are in a language that they understand, even if that's it and you have to stop after that, you've made a meaningful contribution to their day that they wouldn't otherwise have had.
But many volunteers in the program are proficient in their language. Which brings us back to Kim Grimaldi. She's a fourth-year graduate student at UT, where she studies Arabic and Persian literature. She says she got involved with the program after a fellowship opportunity took her to Jordan.
I saw a lot of refugees in Jordan and didn't feel like I was in a very good position to help. And so when I got back, I was very committed to making sure that I was in a position to do something.
She's been volunteering for about a year now. Grimaldi's Arabic is advanced, so she's rotated throughout the district, going where she's most needed. When I asked about her experience with the kids who've only recently been resettled, the ones whose language skills need the most work, Grimaldi tells me about the time she tried to explain the word fossil.
Okay, so let's think about how we know that dinosaurs existed. And so this is all happening in Arabic. I would ask them, like, كيف تعرف إنه كان ديناصورات في الماضي? And they'd start guessing. Well, you know, maybe there were corpses of dinosaurs. And I'm like, well, yes, but do you think they'd last for 65 million years? They're like, no. Okay, so what's left? Okay, the bones.
And they continue this exchange in Arabic as a group until the kids are confident in the English meaning. Grimaldi calls this a negotiation of linguistic boundaries. They may not know all the words in English, and she may not know every word in Arabic, but they're able to figure it out together. Maria Arabo is AISD's refugee family support specialist. She says these interactions are vital, since many of these kids have made it here through unthinkable circumstances.
You know, Iraqi refugees, Syrian refugees, who've had a vast amount of traumatic experiences, for sure, and also access to education is really varied in a war zone. And so many of them have come with interrupted education. So for students to not be able to understand anything, step in the UT students.
Back at Harris Elementary, Grimaldi is wrapping up with Amira and Sajeda. It's time to go back to class.
That was so short.
I know. It's always too short. And I'm not gonna see you guys anymore before summer.
Why?
Because you guys have a field trip tomorrow, and you've got
all sorts of fun stuff. Can you come tomorrow?
I can't come on the field trip. I'm sorry.
The girls are heartbroken to see Grimaldi leave. They did their best to make the walk back to class take as long as possible. But Grimaldi will be back at the start of the school year, and her kids will be eagerly waiting.
Nadia Hamdan of KUT brought us that story. Coming up next on Fronteras, experiencing the art of Mexican fine dining.
We're cooking in front of them. They're part of the whole scenario. They're family. They're, you know, they come and sit at my mom's table.
A scenario that costs more than your average taco plate. We'll explore this pricey new trend after this. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio. Welcome back to Fronteras. An update now on SB 4, the Texas Sanctuary Cities Law. Some critics call it the Show Me Your Papers Law. Now the state is trying to move the lawsuit against it from a federal court in San Antonio to one in Austin. Texas Public Radio's Ryan Poppy has more.
The multi-city lawsuit against the state of Texas asked that SB 4, the Anti-Sanctuary Cities Law, be declared unconstitutional. The suit was filed in federal court in San Antonio, but the Texas Attorney General's office argued before Federal District Judge Sam Sparks in Austin that because the lawsuit involves state-elected officials, it should take place in the capital city. Renee Hicks is an attorney representing the city of El Seniso and Maverick County in an effort to keep the constitutional challenge in San Antonio.
To change venue, the judge first has to basically say he has jurisdiction over the case. And I think the judge said it as many ways as he can. You know, he's highly dubious that he has jurisdiction over this case.
If Judge Sparks decides to take up the case, he's also being asked by the AG's office to have the original lawsuit thrown out by declaring the law constitutional. The law itself, which takes effect on September 1st, will allow local police to question someone about their immigration status even during something as routine as a traffic stop. It requires local officials to comply with all federal immigration requests to detain someone. The judge did not provide a timeline when he might rule on the state's request. The AG's office refused to comment until after the judge has ruled on the matter. Reporting in Austin, I'm Ryan Poppy.
There's no argument that Texans love Mexican food, but will they pay more to eat it? Texas is filled with taquerias and Tex-Mex restaurants, but there aren't many places that focus on Mexican fine dining. In Dallas, the Revolver Taco Lounge is changing that with its new dinner concept. As KERA's Gus Contreras reports, it's bucking the trend that good Mexican food has to be cheap.
Regino Rojas is from Michoacán, Mexico. And he doesn't do Tex-Mex.
Me as a Mexican and raised and born over there, I don't get it at all. I think it's really bad Mexican food. But, people enjoy it. That's because people were born and raised with that stuff here, you know? They have never really been exposed to the real deal and the real flavors.
And that real deal is what he's adding to the North Texas food scene. Rojas started off by opening his original Revolver Taco Lounge in Fort Worth, and it became a hit. He opened the Dallas location in April and says it's the perfect spot for his new idea, a fancier side to his taco lounge.
People in this neighborhood, they come with a different mentality. They come, you know, they want to try different things. It's the Pelham.
And with the opening of the Dallas restaurant out of the way, Rojas is focusing on his Purépecha room, named after an indigenous group from back home. It's in a private room at the back of the restaurant. And Rojas's inspiration? The meals his mom used to cook him at home. Customers get a home-cooked meal from scratch by his mom and other Mexican women. Rojas says it's designed to feel like you're in a Mexican home.
We're cooking in front of them. They're part of the whole scenario. They're family. They're, you know, they come and sit at my mom's table type of thing. So it's going to be fun, man.
The concept of modern Mexican dining is catching fire in places like Los Angeles and Chicago. In 2015... Dallas Morning News food critic Leslie Brenner wrote a feature about how Mexican fine dining was taking off across Dallas-Fort Worth.
Since then, a number of the restaurants that I mentioned excitedly in the story have closed. So I sort of feel like it's this thing that should be happening here big time. It's one of the most exciting food movements going on in the world right now, and we should be doing it here. And we are not as much as I wish we were.
Chef Anthony Bourdain says the food is underappreciated. He talked about it on a recent episode of his CNN show, Parts Unknown.
But their expectation is Mexican food should be cheap. And the fact is, there's always going to be new arrivals from Mexico who are perfectly willing to sell you, unfortunately or fortunately, really good Mexican food for very cheap, but not the kind of deep, flavors that, you know, you find or I found in my travels there.
And those deep flavors are what Rojas is trying to show off. Not just the hits, like fancy tacos al pastor at swanky places in uptown Dallas. One of the items on Rojas' rotation is medium-rare duck in a traditional mole sauce.
I'm respecting my culture, and I'm showing them that it can be done, man. Just respect the techniques and stuff. And, you know, people is not stupid, man. People know when they're eating a good ribeye taco or when they're eating a really bad, you know, skirt steak, low-quality taco.
But are people willing to drop $85 for what some things should be cheap?
That's what I'm doing, a small place. I don't know if it will work with one of those big, you know, massive places. You know, I don't think I will not do it at all. But low-key, very underground, very, you know, 12 people, that's it. Two sittings a night.
An experiment he hopes not only works for him, but for the Mexican food scene in North Texas. Gus Contreras.
For Fronteras.
And that's it for Fronteras and our stories from the Southwest this week. You can find the show under the Programs tab on our website, tpr.org. Alexis Yancey produced the broadcast. Shelley Koffler is our executive producer. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. Thanks for joining us. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.